And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, we're going to be speaking with the author Michael Cannell. He's written a book about New York City police and the mafia. So we're going to be talking about Blood and the Badge, a new book by Michael Cannell. He's written biographies of I.M. Pei and Formula One drivers and all sorts of subjects, and it's a fascinating look at the underworld and its interaction and intersection with the New York City Police Department. So that's tomorrow. Joining me now is the author Elizabeth Evetts Dickinson. She's an award-winning author whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Harper's, The Washington Post Magazine, and many other publications. Her new book is out today. It's about a fashion designer named Claire McCardle. McCardle grew up in Frederick and went on to become one of the most influential designers in New York and around the world. It's called Claire McCardle, The Designer Who Set Women Free. And Elizabeth Evetts Dickinson joins me in Studio B. It's good to see you.
It's great to be here.
And congratulations on the book. This is a figure I knew nothing about before I read it and really enjoyed it. You talk about she made leotards and leggings and hoodies and denim and leather and stuff. She brought that into the world of women's wear. She changed the way people think about swimsuits. She put pockets on clothes. She did these, you know, things that at one time just never were done before. You say in the right at the beginning of the book that we owe much of what hangs in our closets to Claire McCardle. She's a really influential person, isn't she?
Truly. In fact, one critic was saying that she's the most influential designer you've never heard of, that she really pioneered much of what we all wear today in the 1930s. So when you think about what was going on in the world and what she was creating at that time, she was so far ahead of her time. She was a true visionary.
And her connection to Frederick is really quite substantial. Her grandfather, I guess, was one of the founders of Hood College.
That's right. So Claire was born in 1905 in Frederick, Maryland, and spent her childhood there. And she had a very traditional upbringing, but her mother was kind of progressive. She really had this belief that a young woman could go on and do what she wanted to do, which at the time, not every family had that belief for their young daughters. And so she not only was expected to go to college, she was encouraged to go to college. And from a very young age, I think both of her parents realized that she was drawn to clothing and drawn to making things. And they encouraged that artistic proclivity in her from an early age.
Were either of her parents, you know, fashionistas? Were they big in clothes? I mean, did she get this proclivity for fashion design from anybody, you know, in her direct family or in her circle in Frederick as a little girl?
Well, her father was a banker, so no. He was very studious and quite intelligent and was well-dressed for the time, but maybe not fashion-forward. But her mother very much was someone who was interested in clothes. And what you have to remember back at that time is you couldn't just go to the store and buy clothes off the rack. There wasn't ready-to-wear. That didn't really exist. So you were either sewing your own clothes or, as the McCardles did, twice a year they would bring in a dressmaker to help make clothes from patterns. And Claire's mother always wanted the best patterns from Vogue because those patterns were drawn from the French, from Paris, which is where at that time all design was coming from. Really, America didn't have a fashion industry yet. It was copies of what Paris was doing.
Yeah, and Claire McCardle had a lot to do with establishing the American fashion industry and the American look, as you chronicle in the book. But it's also fascinating to think about what you report about the place of clothes in culture. In the 1800s, we had these decency laws where it was actually illegal in some places to be in public wearing clothes that weren't indicative of, you know, your birth gender. I mean, you get arrested if you're a woman for wearing pants.
That's right. And I mean, even in Claire's life, she was required in the 1920s when she went to Big Pool, Maryland for summer camp to wear wool swim stockings. Women were not supposed to have bare legs on public beaches, God forbid, right? And one of the things I loved in researching this book was seeing how early on Claire was very subtly but very directly challenging these dress codes. She rolled off those swim stockings so she could actually go swimming in the lake. She got in trouble. But really, her biggest priority was having clothes that fit the reason. And that reason that day was to swim. And those swim stockings got in the way.
You talk about how there were media reports blaming divorce and domestic abuse and homicides and stuff on what women were wearing.
That's right. With the flapper trend that came into the 20s, I even found one hilarious article where women bobbing their hair was blamed for a warehouse closing down. It was a warehouse that made hair ribbons. So they even blamed women for short hair ruining entire industries.
The book is Claire McArdle, The Designer Who Set Women Free. The author is my guest, Elizabeth Evetts Dickinson. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. You can call us at 410-662-8780. If you have a question for Elizabeth, our email midday@wipr.org. So Claire McArdle was a very industrious, hardworking, inquisitive person, as you chronicle in this terrific book. I'm really intrigued how she and a friend would, they did eventually end up in Paris, where the, as you say, the sort of nexus of all the fashion world was. And they pooled their money and they bought some of these highfalutin French fashions. And then she took a device, I don't know what implement she used, but she took them apart.
She took a seam ripper to one of the most expensive dresses she'd probably ever held in her hands. That's exactly right. So it's the 1920s. Imagine being in Paris during, you know, the Hemingway time, right? It's just roaring 20s in Paris. She's there with Parsons, the school that she went to study fashion in. At the time, though, the education was really about illustration. You were meant to be able to illustrate the clothes. It really wasn't about making clothes as a designer, but Claire always had this idea that she wanted to make original clothes, but she needed to understand how they were put together, how they really worked. And so she sat on the floor of this tiny atelier and, you know, cold in Paris, and ripped apart this dress made by a very famous French haute couturier named Madeleine Vianney. And she basically taught herself how to construct clothes.
You know, I love that. It's like taking the engine apart to see how the car works, or taking the toaster apart to see how it works.
That's exactly right. She always had this very smart engineering brain in a lot of ways, and she put that to good use.
You also talk about the rise of the department store and what that meant for, as you say, ready-to-wear fashion, because then all of a sudden there was a place that women eventually could go, and men, I guess, to see things. But in the 1920s, men had their men's clubs and women had department stores. That's what they were used for.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it was interesting to remember that when Claire arrived in New York in the 1920s, it was very difficult to be a single woman in a city. There weren't hotels that would put single women up because it was worried that they might be working women. There weren't a lot of places for them to live. She luckily found an art club called the Three Arts Club that was specifically for women, single women in the city. And the same was true with public spaces. You couldn't go out to dinner without a male escort. You couldn't go into certain places unless you were married. And so department stores not only were these palaces of consumption, as they were called at the time, but you could go there and you could mail letters. You could sit for hours with friends. You could stroll. They almost became the women's clubs at that time for women like Claire.
Yeah, the guy in Boston, Edward Filene, who founded Filene's department store, Filene's Basement down in downtown Boston, was a very famous place that people would go to, including 14-year-old boys like myself, because there were no dressing rooms. And so the women would take off their clothes and try on the new clothes right in the aisles. So you could go down and see women in their underwear. If you're 14, this was a very good thing. So I'm a big fan of Filene's from way back.
Well, but I think it was actually Filene who said originally, he called department stores in the 20s, the Adamless Eden,
yeah.
because there at the time it was mostly women, but you were in the heyday where it was everybody.
Yeah, by the 1960s it was 14-year-olds.
Different story.
Like
yeah.
they let us in. This fashion industry was completely male dominated. They were making clothes for women, but there were men designing them. There were not very many women fashion designers, and Claire McArdle had, a barrier to face that many women in other professions had as well. It was a male-dominated culture, and she had to fight that tooth and nail her whole life, didn't she?
She did, and really, you have to remember, there wasn't an American fashion industry at the time as we think of it, where there was this designer at the head of the firm, and they were multifaceted and putting out all of these different types of clothes and accessories. Really, at the time, it was manufacturing. It was the garment district in New York, and these manufacturers would hire young women like Claire to go abroad, steal the styles from Paris, come back, and copy them. So Claire always wanted to get away from this fashion theft that she was seeing, because she had a vision for unstructured, beautiful sports clothes that women could wear all day, every day in the city, move about. It's really what we all wear today. But at the time, where it was very formal and you were meant to wear a morning dress in the morning and a tea gown for tea time and an evening dress, she not only was kind of revolutionizing away from the male manufacturing model, but also this imprimatur to always wear different outfits throughout the day and to truss yourself up in corsets and understructures that made it difficult, frankly, to move and live your life.
I was fascinated that you said that Christian Dior, the other big designer at the time, certainly the person who probably to this day still has a lasting influence on what people are wearing, got rid of the corset in what was called the new look. And one of the reasons was that men found it uncomfortable when they were dancing with women to have that hard thing that they had to hold on. It's
yeah.
like the poor woman has to wear the darn thing. And, that didn't seem to enter Monsieur Dior's head.
Well, you bring up an interesting moment in fashion history that's a part of this book, which is, during the 30s and 40s, there was a lot of invention in design that Claire pioneered. She was creating ballet flats. She was creating mix and match separates. She was creating clothes that didn't require corsets. But then the war ends, and Christian Dior presents his first new collection in 1947. And he brought back what I think many of us now think of as that traditional 1950s look. He originally had a very tight corset with an 18-inch waist, these shoulder pads and hip pads and push-up bras. So you had wide shoulders, a very thin waist, wide hips in the dress. And eventually, he got rid of that corset. One woman put it on and said, "My God, I feel like I'm in a straitjacket," and lasted less than 15 minutes. It was so tight. he wasn't thinking too much about the women. He was thinking of the women as objects. And that was very much against McArdle's philosophy.
And at one point, he's quoted as saying, "I brought back the neglected art of pleasing."
That's right.
So that you got dressed for somebody else.
That's right.
You got dressed for your husband or your boyfriend or your suitor.
And you had to get help to get dressed. One of the things that Claire did was she always put her zippers and her closures on the side or the front within easy reach, because she lived alone in New York from up until 40 when
didn't
she got married.
Didn't have anybody to zip up the back of the dress.
That's right. And so she had this great quote once where she said, "You may live alone and love it, but not unless you wrench out your arm trying to zip up a back zipper."
Elizabeth Evans Dickinson, her new book is called Claire McArdle, The Designer Who Set Women Free. There's a launch event for the book tonight at the Maryland Center for History and Culture, but that event is sold out. But there is an exhibition there that includes some of Claire McArdle's clothes, and that'll be up for a while. Elizabeth Evans Dickinson will also be discussing her book next week on June 26th at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. And we will have more with Elizabeth today here on Midday after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Elizabeth Evetts Dickinson. She lives here in Baltimore. Her new book chronicles the life of Claire McCardle, an internationally acclaimed fashion designer whose early years were spent in Frederick. It's called Claire McCardle, the Designer Who Set Women Free. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or email us midday at wipr.org. Let's go to the phones to Pat, who's on the line in Parkton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you?
We're doing great. What's on your mind?
Well, when you said Claire McCardle, it rang a lot of bells because my family absolutely adored her. My father and his siblings grew up playing with her, and they couldn't stop talking about her. They were so proud of her success. So they were constantly making me look at her work in any magazine it turned up in or anything like that. And it was wonderful. And I could see that early on, how incredible it was. I still love her. I would wear her clothes every day if I could possibly get them. And I'm an artist now. And they had me drawing from her her photographs and things in magazines. And I think it had something to do with my recognizing a lot of art principles that you don't know you're learning, but you are learning.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for checking in, Pat. I'm really appreciative. Thanks so much. And Elizabeth, we have an email from Herbert who says, "What a lovely topic. Loved Claire McCardle from the time I ran into a McCardle exhibit at a museum when I was visiting to see the Muppets exhibition. I loved McCardle's the exhibit about her. What a classy designer. I'm going to read your book." You make a point right at the end of the book that it's difficult to find McCardle clothes that are in good condition because people who owned them wore them until they were rags. I mean, they did not revere them like some museum piece. They wore them all the time.
That's right. So I will say to Pat, if she ever finds some, let me know. I'm listening. You know, that was the thing. McCardle believed that comfort was pivotal to style. She always believed that a woman should feel comfortable in her clothes. And to that end, people who bought McCardle's clothes, they were designed to last. She really was the first to marry high fashion with mass technology, mass production. And so it's hard to find really pristine Claire McCardle's today, although we're lucky to have many in the Maryland Center for History and Culture's exhibition.
Yeah, so you can see them here in Baltimore. I'm really fascinated in her invention, essentially, of clothes with pockets. She put pockets on clothes that heretofore had not had pockets. And on the one hand, they're utility. I mean, there's a utilitarian reason for them. You put stuff in them. You put your purse or your, not your purse, but maybe a couple of coins, maybe your keys or something like that. But there's more than that. It's more than just putting stuff in it, isn't there?
That's right. And, you know, Claire certainly wasn't the first to put pockets in clothes, but getting pockets in women's wear, particularly women's wear that everyone was wearing, not just, you know, these custom-made gowns that some people could put pockets into, that was really hard. And she always fought her male bosses when she was younger to try and get pockets into everything, skirts, pants, dresses. I mean, good Lord, we're still trying to get pockets in women's clothes today. Because Claire understood the psychological importance of clothing. It wasn't just that you needed a place to stash your stuff. It's that you could put your hands in your pocket if you felt awkward, or you look effortlessly cool when you sort of are trying to be at a cocktail party and you put your hand in a pocket. So she was always thinking about the full experience of what it was to wear her clothing. And I just so admire that about her.
Talk about her innovations in swimsuits. You mentioned, you know, she took her wool legging stockings off of her legs when she wanted to go to jump in the lake at camp. But women's swimsuits certainly have, evolved considerably over time.
Yeah, well, at the time, they were called bathing suits for a reason. You were just meant to sort of dip and bathe in them. You know, there the birth of what McArdle designed is also really the birth of women in sports. It's about creating sportswear that really worked for the intended purpose. And so she just scandalized people on beaches when she would come out with bathing suits that, oh my God, went between your legs. And one of them she jokingly called the diaper suit because it looked like a diaper, but it's what we now know to be, you know, the modern swimsuit. She found wool jerseys that dried quicker so that you could get out of the water and dry quickly. Her main priority was not only to look good, but also to be able to swim, to be able to sit on the beach and to have a good day and not have your bathing suit fail you or look like a dress.
Yeah, I mean, there was a purpose to these things that you know, transcended just fashion and looking good. Talk about one of her most famous styles, the monastic dress. That sounds very nun-like.
It does, and it's funny because this really was her breakout dress. It was 1938, and it's what a lot of us think about today as a simple dress you would wear to work. You pull it over your head. It was not structured at all, so there was no boning in the bodice or anything tight to hold it in place. And it basically was a simple dress you could wear, and then you could size it to your own body by putting a belt on it or wrapping spaghetti ties around the center. What Claire understood is women needed clothes that could fit easily and that didn't also always need to be tailored. We know how hard it is to find ready-to-wear clothes that fit. So she figured out ways to get around it by designing a dress that you could effectively fit to your own body.
Let's go back to the phones to a caller from Frederick, Claire McArdle's hometown. This is Julia. Welcome to the show with Elizabeth Evitts Dickinson.
Thank you so much. Elizabeth, I look forward to reading your book. I have one question for you. Given the impact that McArdle has had on women's fashion, why is it that so few people outside the fashion industry know about her?
You asked one of the questions that really sent me down the road of research on this book, and I think it's a couple of things. First, McArdle died young. She died at 52. And at the time, there really was no succession plan for ready-to-wear designers in New York like there was today. She, again, was very ahead of her time. So when she died, her label effectively died with her. I also think, though, that there was this entire generation of women between the wars. Claire was at the center of a constellation of extraordinary women who effectively birthed American fashion as we know it today. And sadly, all of their names have been forgotten. And so part of what this book hopes to do is not only celebrate Claire, but celebrate the women-led entrepreneurialism that built what we know today of American fashion.
Well, the book is a really fun read. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Evitts Dickinson. It's called Claire McArdle, the designer who set women free. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And there's a book launch tonight at the Maryland Center for History and Culture. That event is sold out, but there is an exhibition of Claire McArdle's clothes that's there for a good long while. And Elizabeth will be speaking about the book next week with the restaurateur and designer Lane Harlan at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. That event starts at 7 o'clock a week from Thursday, June 26. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, I'll speak with the author Michael Cannell about his new book called Blood and the Badge. Fresh Air is up next now after news at the top of the hour. Today's guest is Larry Charles, who's been part of shows like Seinfeld and Entourage and movies like Borat. So stick around for that. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.